Welcome to Tisky Sour. Sorry for the slight delay, but I think you got to enjoy. Is it our new soundtrack that's on there at the moment? By 65 Days of Static?
It's literally today years old.
Yeah. So we didn't go 5 minutes late purely by accident. There was also, I mean, we can make up a post facto reason there. We are not yet in our new studio, but we will be soon. But we are already ramping up our output because when politics speeds up, so do we. There'll be more and more Tisky Sours. I think we'll probably do about a three a week until a general election, at which point I imagine they will be nightly. I'm here with Aaron Bastani.
What's up? How are you doing? Just for viewers out there, by the way, am I in focus? We've had a conversation about am I in focus, Michael or not?
I am. I can see my face on this.
Michael's crystal clear as ever. Just feedback, very, very welcome. But other than that, if I'm in focus, all's good.
Someone's asked if the delay was because you were putting on makeup, but that only took about a minute. We're going to talk about three things today. First of all, the Queen's speech, or the Queen being forced to preview the Tory party manifesto. Second, reported beef at the top of the Labour Party, and even a potential divide between Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell.
That's why everybody's here, right?
Yeah, people just love the gossip.
The goss.
We always promise gossip on this show, and I don't know if we, you know, come up with the goods as often as we should.
In the early days, we used to. Before this was actually broadcast, like when we used to do just a podcast on Tisky, it was actually very funny anyway.
And finally, which some people, according to some sources, is the source of the beef between Corbyn and McDonnell, whether or not Labour should seek a second referendum before or after a general election. And I think me and Aaron have slightly different positions on that. So, you know, maybe we'll tease out some.
So somebody's saying I'm not in
debate.
Focus.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You carry on, Michael.
Okay.
Cut the camera to Michael. I think James, it's James Fox, isn't it? James Fox, who's filling in for Gary tonight. I said, look, let's do autofocus. James, in his infinite wisdom, said, let's do manual. But look, here's the thing. If you go to support.navarramedia.com, you can help us have the hardware where this kind of thing isn't really a technical issue. Because Michael doesn't need any help. I need all the help.
Well, the problem
get.
Is what's happening now is the audience are disagreeing as to whether or not you're in focus.
Well, no, but now it's
like
been
the blue dress, purple dress. No, that was already happening. But anyway, you look great now. I can see you up on the screen there.
Thank you, Michael.
We are going to start by talking about the Queen's speech. And this is technically difficult because we just got James in here to refocus the cameras. And now I'm going to ask him to put on a clip. So we are really putting James Fox through the motions today. We're going to start with the Queen's speech, a little clip of it. She got all dressed up. It would be a shame to let that effort go unnoticed. Obviously, this wasn't a particularly usual Queen's speech. Normally, the point of this is the Prime Minister puts down into writing his legislative agenda for the next session of Parliament. These are laws that will be passed over the following year, usually. This time around, that's not what it's doing because Boris Johnson doesn't have a majority and he is, in fact, calling for election as soon as possible. So we know none of these laws will go into being before that election. So it was really a propaganda exercise. We're just going to watch the first minute of that now.
My Lords and members of the House of Commons, my government's priority has always been to secure the United Kingdom's departure from the European Union on the 31st of October. My government intends to work towards a new partnership with the European Union based on free trade and friendly cooperation. My ministers will work to implement new regimes for fisheries, agriculture, and trade, seizing the opportunities that arise from leaving the European Union. An immigration bill ending free movement will lay the foundation for a fair, modern, and global immigration system. My government remains committed to ensuring that resident European citizens who have built their lives in and contributed so much to the United Kingdom have the right to remain. The bill will include measures that reinforce this commitment.
Boris Johnson's smug face in the audience is really something to witness there, isn't it? Also, I mean, that outfit. I mean, what is she doing there? You'd have thought, I think, I'm a Republican, but if we're going to have a monarchy, I think we should do it with just a little bit more taste.
Look, it's 2019. Let's turn it down. Let's go for a sort of more sober palette. Get rid of the big hefty stones. What we should do is what's really interesting, a lot of people don't know this, is that most of the crown jewels only date back to Charles II, because Oliver Cromwell melted.
No.
Pretty much everything. Yeah. And they sold off the jewels and they melted all the metals. And they said that basically the jewels of the crown is the technical name for the crown jewels. These were, you know, obsessed only by people that are stupid enough to fall for superstition. 350 years later, they're still pulling the same old tricks.
Hmm. The contents of the speech. Nothing was particularly surprising. As I say, none of these things will be going into law. But it was a panoply, a bizarre selection of populist policies. And I say that in the pejorative sense of just a politician who is picking out of a hat random policies. The only thread running through them is that he thinks they'll be popular. There doesn't seem to be any vision or anything else that links them together. Yeah. Obviously, yeah. The first was Brexit. So that is, you know, the raison d'etre of this government. The Queen has to stand up and say, we will be leaving, or the priority in this government is to leave on the 31st of October. Even though we all know that's not going to happen. He didn't manage to get her to say, get Brexit done. I think that probably would have been, veering into constitutional crises if you were just giving her the slogan of the Tory party general election.
I'm sure her advisors got rid of some problematic lines.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, it's always a negotiation, right?
I'm watching The Queen at the moment. I'm quite late to it, but...
Oh, it's great, isn't it?
Well, she's cool in it, isn't she?
Claire Foy.
Yeah.
Also, she's like, she's drop dead gorgeous. And like, so is, what's his name for Prince Philip?
Mm.
The guy that plays
especially
him.
Especially with the beard.
He's quite handsome. You're like, give me a fucking break. It wasn't like this. And Princess Margaret, although she actually was quite attractive in real life, apparently. Bit of a heartbreaker.
The end. So these populist policies, we've got the end of freedom of movement for EU citizens. We knew this already. Paves the way for a points-based immigration system. Surprisingly says Irish citizens will generally be able to enter and live freely in the UK. So I thought that was always going to be guaranteed. I thought people who lived in Ireland or Irish people would have special status in terms of freedom of movement.
And that precedes UK. That precedes EU membership anyway. Yeah.
But we're just saying they generally will. So I'm not sure what is outside of that. A financial services bill which will simplify the process by which overseas investment funds can be solved in the UK. So financial deregulation is what the Conservative Party thinks this country needs in the year 2019. A sentencing bill which would make the usual release date for people convicted of violent or sexual offences 2/3 instead of half the sentence. Now this is veering into that kind of populist policy where, to be honest, as someone without expertise in sentencing law, this sounds entirely reasonable, and I assume that's exactly why they chose it.
Yeah.
And there's a few of these, really. So we've also got a foreign national offenders bill. So obviously populism, you go hard on crime, you go hard on migration. Populism squared is you go hard on criminal migrants.
How about criminal migrant nonces?
Criminal migrant nonces criminal migrant nonces who hid a body and haven't told the courts where they've done it. That's one of the later crimes in Boris Johnson's priorities for Britain. It's going to make it harder for criminals to get parole if they don't disclose where they have buried their victim. it's named after someone. It's called Helen's Law. So presumably, like, there is a background here where there was a criminal who didn't, you know, say where his victim was buried. But the idea that this is in, you know, the priority of government at this period in time is bizarre electioneering. And longer sentences for animal abusers, which will, again, is chosen.
I'm down with that.
It's a bit, to be honest, like when Labour goes, we'll let people who rent have pets in the house. Although I do really back that policy.
I think that's an important policy. Because also, you know, there's a correlation between having a pet and enhanced mental well-being, happiness, life expectancy. So why should you be denied that?
And new charges on single-use plastics. I was wondering if you had any, you know, given that the running thread here is whatever bizarre niche issue is very difficult to disagree with. So the fact that if you kill someone and you don't tell the courts where you buried the victim, then you're not going to get parole.
Yeah.
Any other examples, any other hypothetical examples that you think Labour could outflank the Tories on? Similar policies?
I think Labour could do something like set up sanctuary cities for badgers.
Ooh.
Kind of like the opposite of badger culls.
Yeah, that's really good. A nice dividing line there. They cull the badgers, we set up sanctuary cities.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of stupid. And it's identity politics. I don't mean identity politics in the sort of pejorative sense used against the left, but like right-wing identity politics appropriated from the US and just the most... You know, it's kind of like NRA-style politics, but obviously we don't have that social base here. So we see glimpses of it, right? Do you remember what's his name? the farmer, Tony Martin, when he shot those burglars in the back.
Yeah.
That was kind of like, and the Tories were trying to create a law whereby you could shoot people in the back if they broke into your property kind of thing.
That's different though, because that's the culture wars. That's when it's like a divisive issue, which is what you have in the United States over the NRA. Whereas the fact that, you know, people who are paedophiles or violent criminals shouldn't be able to get out on 50% of the time, but they should wait for the 66% of the time. That's not a cultural divide running through Britain.
No,
but that is just, they've noticed something in the legal system that looks odd and they're saying, we're going to correct it. But not based on what is a priority for the country, but what they think will sell well in the Daily Express.
I think the thing about like dead bodies is clearly they've done some focus groups and they're like, this is the one. This is a good wedge issue. I mean,
but a wedge issue, doesn't the other party have to disagree? Presumably we're going to put that in our manifesto, or are we going to have leaders debates where we're saying, no, actually we should let them out after 50% of the time, and no, actually parole shouldn't be affected by whether or not you reveal the location of the person you killed.
Well, the thing is sort of neoliberal counter-revolution has been successful over the last 40 years precisely because it's made the left's obviously been dead and buried for the best part of the last 40 years, obsess over quite trivial things, you know? So, for instance, Ed Miliband, he couldn't really have a propositional offer. Well, he arguably could have, he didn't, he chose not to, because it was about, oh, he's in, you know, Alex Salmond's pocket.
Mm.
They do triviality very, very well. Another one was the 1992 general election campaign about some kid's ear. Do you know this?
Oh, I've seen it sort of in articles, but I didn't actually know what the reference
1992,
was.
1992, there's a Labour election ad, and it's about this kid, or they picked up on a story about this kid having an ear infection or something, and he had to wait in hospital for ages. Basically, the Tories found out it's kind of like a bogus story. And so they just went to town on like this ear. It's like utterly trivial, mad story. 13 years of Thatcherism, deindustrialization, destroyed public services, a war against working class people, and the Tories succeeded and won in 1992 precisely because they made the talking point this kid's ear. You know, that's what they do. So we should be wary of like these kind of nutty, seemingly microscopic, unimportant issues. That's what they're going to try and do, pin us down on that stuff, rather than have that bigger picture, talking about wages, talking about popular prosperity, you know, the stuff that really gets people energised.
That was like the Ed Miliband thing. So he had an advisor, which was David Axelrod, over from the Obama campaign. Well, I think he was chief strategist for Obama, and he, you know, in his damning... I mean, to be honest, when you get strategists who work on a losing campaign, always they have to write a book afterwards which says, I gave them great advice and everything they did was shit. But his version of that was to say that they basically said, vote Labour, get a microwave, because all of their policies were so piecemeal and uninspirational that people were like, well, life could be very marginally better with Ed Miliband, or I will, you know, not take the risk given that all the tabloids are telling me there is a risk, and I'll keep with the status quo. I think it's probably going to be harder for the Conservative Party to win on single-use plastics and animal abuse against
the
Labour
Party.
Nobody cares
about that stuff. But also, where the Tories be successful in terms of a big story is fund the NHS, hang nonces. And it's kind of, this is kind of hinting at that, but they didn't really go to town on it. And I guess we're going to talk about that over the course of the show. Why didn't they go to town? Why wasn't there more in this Queen's speech? Are they holding back some really big policies for a general election announcement quite soon? Probably.
Do you think they will be?
I think that it's strange to have talked about so little and made it such an unexciting, broadly vacuous speech, given we could have a general election this year. I'm inclined to think we might not, but we could.
I mean, the other possibility is they're not exactly sure what kind of election they're going to be fighting at this point, right? So do they fight the populist general election campaign of get Brexit done, or do they fight that we've done Brexit already, now we're actually a fairly liberal party, you can just vote for us, it's safe, fine. A reassuring election campaign.
No, because
they don't quite know which one they're going
to do. The existential threat to them, right? That's the existential threat. Yeah, they need to win over wavering, quote, soft Tories from the Lib Dems. Sure, you know, they would want to take some... They'd want to win some unionist seats off maybe Labour. Well, they've lost all their seats in Scotland, you know. So it's the Brexit Party. They need to get those people back. They've just got 9% in the European election. I know it's a low-turnout, unimportant election, but they've got 9%. Brexit Party got mid-30s. Those are the voters they need to win back.
The hang nonces one is interesting, actually, because the golden spot for the Conservative Party, hang nonces wouldn't be a good one, because I don't think it's quite popular enough. So I think people would...
No, it's about 20% of the country.
Too many people would find that a horrific policy proposal. But at the other end of the spectrum, you've got, you know, people shouldn't get parole if they don't tell the courts where they buried their victim. That's at the other end of the spectrum, because it's not going to become a wedge issue, because the Labour Party are obviously going to agree. So they need to find this one policy which is really attuned with the country at large, but which the Labour Party can in no way agree with. And that's a proper wedge issue. And I don't think any of these are that.
No. No. I think also that people are saying, what's a nonce in the comments, which is interesting. Somebody's written, and because if you hung the nonces, you'd gut the Tory party. No comment. Although there was an amazing...
Nonce is a paedophile.
There was an amazing story.
Is that a British thing?
Yeah, I think so. There was an amazing story, and I did a sort of Twitter video, and it got like 100,000 views earlier this year, about a Tory councillor who was under investigation for sexual abuse of children, sexual assault, inappropriate touching, etc. And while he was under investigation, not only was he not suspended by the Conservative Party, he was promoted to deputy mayor. And where was the media coverage?
Well, that should be in the Labour Party manifesto, that if a sitting councillor is convicted of noncery,
Is charged with,
yeah, they can't get promoted to be deputy mayor, because the Conservative Party will either have to oppose it or be accused of hypocrisy. I think that could be our wedge issue.
There you go.
You can have that one for free, Seamus. Should we move on to gossip, speaking of Labour Party staffers? So, trouble at the top of Labour. This has been the explosive story, which is spreading, you know, it's causing lots of debates and arguments on Twitter. It's hit the pages of the Sunday Times. The Squawk Box is obviously covering it in detail.
Covering it.
It is the purported division between Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, or to be more specific, some specific staffers around Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell. So to talk through the narrative of what happened last week, Carrie Murphy, who has been Corbyn's chief of staff since 2016, was moved out of the leader's office and into party HQ. That was widely seen as a demotion. She was the boss of the leader's office, and now I'm not sure, she's head of digital campaigns or something in HQ.
She was a chief of staff, and now she's got a temporary job.
Yeah. In any case, she's got a lot less power.
Head of digital for the forthcoming general election campaign.
She was close to Len McCloskey. Well, she still is close to Len McCloskey. And I suppose the first impression everyone had of Carrie Murphy was that she got Jeremy Corbyn's office in order in 2016 when it all looked a bit hopeless and a bit of a mess.
Yeah.
She sort of got it all together,
cut
down on the number of leaks, cut down on the number of people in that office who were, I mean, quite openly trying to bring down Jeremy Corbyn
kind
as leader of the Labour Party.
For the first year, there were people literally on the Labour payroll working in Corbyn's office trying to get rid of him as the Labour leader. Kind of amazing.
And they needed some, because obviously Jeremy Corbyn's good at a lot of things. Getting rid of people who are trying to undermine him from the inside is not one of them.
Yeah.
So you kind of needed a brutal boss to get in there and get rid of some of these people, get the house in order. But since then, she's rubbed a few people up the wrong way, I think. Partly this has to do with the Remain issue. So there were lots of people in the shadow cabinet who've been pushing for Labour to adopt a more Remain-y position for a while. And people have seen the resistance as coming from, I suppose, her faction in the leader's office. The Tom Watson fiasco. So trying to get rid of Tom Watson, but failing, that was also blamed on...
Or choosing not to, right?
Well...
Choosing not to.
Well, it wasn't her. It was Corbyn and McDonnell the next day.
Yeah, it was a failure. There was a majority in the NEC to get rid of him.
No, but it was a failure because it was supposed to happen in one go, right? It was supposed to happen in one foul swoop.
Yeah.
Or anyway, it was a failure because if you look at how it turned out, that obviously wasn't a successful move.
Yeah. Right?
And I'm also saying this isn't... I'm not necessarily saying these are all bad things. These are what some of the beef is about. And the other purported beef is between her and... Not necessarily beef between her and Andrew Fisher, but that Carrie Murphy's been somewhat blamed for Andrew Fisher's departure, which happened at the Labour Party conference very dramatically on Saturday. On Saturday at Labour Party conference about 3 weeks ago now. So then she has, since then, for these reasons or others, depending on who you believe on the internet, she was pushed out thanks to the efforts of John McDonnell. So apparently he was at the end of his tether. At these various elements of her management of that office, and she has now been pushed over into HQ. There's been lots of briefing against John McDonnell because of this. So the Squawk Box, which is an online magazine quite close to Carrie Murphy, has been briefing that John McDonnell is trying to isolate Jeremy Corbyn, and he's either trying to get rid of him or control him.
Mm.
I don't know what you think about all of this drama, Aaron. What should our audience believe?
People love drama, us included. I think first it's important to say that Navarra, we don't bullshit our listeners. We're entirely clear about what's going on. We don't, you know, we don't give you the spin. And so first thing is, when Kerry Murphy entered Jeremy Corbyn's office, it was in dire straits. It was a shambles. He was in big trouble. The people that she replaced weren't doing a very good job. She came in, she steadied the ship. 2016 with the chicken coup, had she not been there, Jeremy Corbyn probably would have gone. We can't say definitely, probably, in my estimation. And then, like you say, what's been brought into question recently is sort of the management style, not just of her, of the team more generally, which is in Andrew Fisher's, you know, alleged letter of
resignation. The letter's now become proof because, well, there was a... This, to be honest, was where I thought, fucking hell. Because Squawk Box, obviously, when Kerry Murphy got moved, there were lots of counter briefings to try and say why this was a bad thing to happen and blaming it on other people in the organisation, which, you know, it makes sense. There's a bit of a power struggle going on. People brief their various organisations. To be honest, I think this is a very unprofessional thing to do. And it's a sign of someone who's lost perspective of what really matters. But anyway, Squawk Box, in a supposed proof of why Kerry Murphy was pushed out for political reasons, published the entirety of Andrew Fisher's resignation letter.
We don't know
letter.
Who it was.
No, Squawk Box did.
Yeah, we don't know who's responsible, because bear in mind...
We don't know who's responsible, yeah, I suppose, but she's close to... Yeah, yeah, we don't know exactly
It's like four people have been
published
moved...
that.
Four or five people have moved sideways. They'll have political associates, they'll have friends, etc., etc. So it's a bit more complicated than just one person.
Yeah, no, I should be clear that...
A whole faction's been sidelined, effectively.
A faction has been sidelined, and... In a dramatic cell phone, they released the whole of Andrew Fisher's quite excruciating resignation letter, which was decrying, basically, he didn't mention anyone by name, but he was decrying the management of the leader's office.
He said it was a dysfunctional office.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the reality is, I mean, you know, Blair's office was dysfunctional when it came to Gordon Brown. You read any history of New Labour. The question is, you know, is politics at the top level? Is there an inherent sort of dysfunctionality to it? Possibly. Possibly, you know, where does the buck stop with John and Jeremy, or the fact that they're left-wing politicians, and the fact that that's just what modern politics looks like now? People say, oh, Alistair Campbell, great spin doctor. How long will Alistair Campbell last in a world where there's Twitter and mobile phones and ubiquitous phone cameras? Much more challenging environment now. So, I don't know. Anyway, as I was saying, she was invaluable. Those are the criticisms put forward by Andrew Fisher. And then the claim is in Squawk Box that because the composite around that Brexit position was one, composite 13-1?
One of them was 13 and one of them was 14. So one of them was the leadership position, which was that we'll back a second referendum, but the Labour Party won't take a position until a special conference.
Yeah. Which won overwhelmingly, but then there's been the videos online and people say, well, not all the delegates in the room necessarily can have a vote. That's true. Although the only CLPs that send lots of people to the conference are from London, which tend to be more Remainy anyway. And that put a lot of noses out of joint. The fact that vote went that way, it surprised a lot of people. Keir Starmer would have been surprised. John McDonnell may have been surprised. People like Paul Mason, Clive Lewis. And look, it's a democratic party. They're allowed to argue their corner. A lot of people were surprised. And the claim in Squawk Box is that then led to Kerry Murphy being pushed out. Do we know if that's true or not? I don't know.
I mean, I think the thing that is a bit ridiculous is this idea that this is a silent coup. So there are obviously lots of people briefing that this is a silent coup. And obviously a coup would be to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. No one's getting rid of Jeremy Corbyn here. Someone's manoeuvred against a staff member. And ultimately, you do have to remember that it's Jeremy Corbyn who is in charge of the people in his office. So if he didn't want this to happen, he could say no.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's kind of patronising to say that, oh, they're just trying to control him or they're trying to remove him because he knows what's going on. And if you get into this language, so where was this quote? There was a quote from a source in the Squawk Box. Oh, so this was from Wednesday. This isn't the Squawk Box, right? This is someone that's briefed them. There are only two potential reasons for wanting to connive to remove her being Murphy. First, so they can isolate and destroy Jeremy, which, I mean, given that they're talking about McDonald, is a slightly ridiculous idea. Second, so they can control him. We won't have long to wait to discover which of these motivations were behind this redeployment. So this idea that either you're out there to destroy or control him and that he doesn't have any agency in this. I mean, you can easily flip that around. Maybe he was trying to rescue Jeremy Corbyn from the control of Carrie Murphy. That's what I don't think that was true either. But what I'm saying is, if you're going to use this silly language whereby you can overthrow Jeremy Corbyn in a coup without actually getting rid of Jeremy Corbyn, but getting rid of who is supposed to be the real leader behind the throne, then I think you're in kind of dangerous and stupid territory, frankly.
Yeah, and this there's this review that's going into the leader's office team, overseen by Bob Kerslake, who was one of the top dogs in the civil service until a few years ago, retired, close to John McDonnell. He's overseeing this review of her team, but the review has been commissioned by both, like you say, Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell. So the idea that it's just being imposed on Jeremy Corbyn isn't true. And look, if the thing is, if you think as a personality, and I don't think that he would be bossed around to do this, then he shouldn't be the Prime Minister. You know, because you're going to get bigger challenges than John McDonnell saying you should change your chief of staff. You're going to have the deep state and the establishment come up against you. Yeah. So, you know, yeah, I agree with you. Although we should probably talk about some of the other things that John McDonnell
talked
about.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about the more interview. Gossip is a bit silly, but yeah. This interview is, there was some, I think, legitimate critiques of John McDonnell from this. So it was quite an unfortunate coincidence, I think, actually, where all of this briefing was going against John McDonnell, which I think was somewhat unreasonable about him being a centrist and him being there to undermine the Corbyn project, when 2 days later an interview was released of him having, you know, a long friendly chat with Alistair Campbell, which has pissed off quite a lot of people. So we're going to show a brief clip of that before discussing the politics of going on, well, this conversation.
Is Tony Blair a war criminal?
No.
Say something positive about Tony.
I just think what he did in Northern Ireland, I'll just always extol what he did there, and I think he'll go down in history for that. And I'm hoping, and I said this previously, I'm hoping he goes down in history for that rather than Iraq, because that sealing that deal, which is actually now under threat a bit, I have to say, it was just magnificent.
Something positive about Gordon?
I actually think when you look back on it, he tackled child poverty, he redistributed wealth and income on a scale that we've not seen before, he put the investment into our public services, I know working with Tony as well, that really transformed people's lives. And in my constituency, you know, we talk about Sure Start centres, but it wasn't just that, it was right the way across. Our schools in London were seen as some of the worst in the country. The London Challenge that he funded transformed them.
So I think you saw there at the beginning of the clip, John McDonnell, when asked the question, is Tony Blair a war criminal, he says no. Other bits from the interview which pissed people off, he said Campbell was welcome back in the party. He said he opposed his expulsion because of his backing of the Lib Dems in the European elections. He said the attempt to remove Tom Watson was a fiasco. And he said he and Corbyn would resign if Labour lose the next general election. What did you think about the controversy around this interview?
Should we go through those one at a time?
We'll do them one at a time. Is Tony Blair a war criminal?
Yes. Or is Alistair Campbell a war criminal, I suppose, is the big question. Tony Blair is absolutely a war criminal. There is definitely an argument that he and a certain advisor, who is now a baroness in the House of Lords, and Jonathan Powell and Alistair Campbell actively misled Cabinet to go to war, to the extent that they wouldn't even give the legal... They didn't want to give the legal advice of the Attorney General at the time to the Cabinet so they could make an informed decision. So there is a huge argument there that Tony Blair is a war criminal, yes.
And it's a war criminal because it's a war of aggression, right?
Yeah, and he was a Democratic leader, and he didn't want his cabinet to be in full receipt of the legal arguments for war. Why? Because he knew that legal argument was compromised.
I suppose we'll go on to the big picture in a moment. Let's go through them one by one. Yeah, Alistair Campbell, should he be welcomed back in the party?
I think, in John's defence, the thing that Alistair Campbell was actually expelled for is something which was brought in by New Labour. This auto-expulsion
thing. Well,
that
was his answer, right? He said the reason you got kicked out was because of the authoritarian policies implemented by Tony Blair in the party.
And I suppose John would say that he shouldn't have been expelled for that, which is a fair answer. Should Alistair Campbell be in the Labour Party? Should somebody with Alistair Campbell's views be in the Labour Party? Sure. If it's a random person. But Alistair Campbell works for a lobbyist. He works for an organisation which its business is interest representation for massive businesses, organisations, etc. And, you know...
What's this?
He works for various... He works freelance communications kind of consultant for all sorts of brands and businesses and organisations. And you do have to wonder, when he says certain things, is it his view or is it him trying to advance a certain interest he's been being paid to advance? And that's a question more broadly for lobbying in modern politics.
I mean, you could say that about so many parties.
You could say about lots of people, but I do think that does bring into question quite a lot of his intentions. Normally speaking, personally, I wouldn't like to see him in the Labour Party, but you have to have rules, and he has to have broken one of the rules to not be in the Labour Party. Do I think the rule that he broke should apply? Probably not. He absolutely was backing the Liberal Democrats, though. Let's be real.
I mean, according to the rules of the Labour Party, he should have been kicked out.
Yes.
Although, I mean, I suppose the argument he makes is that we always made reasonable exceptions. But, I mean, it seems like if you have a rule, then obviously the most powerful people in the party
so
still have to be.
He goes, was it? You fucking know it was. And he goes, but it was badly applied. No, it's literally called auto-expulsion. That's the point. There is no ability to say, oh, let's apply a bit of context here or a bit of thought, take a bit of initiative. It's literally automatic expulsion. You know that because it was implemented when your guy was in charge.
Said the attempt to remove Tom Watson was a fiasco.
It was a fiasco.
I mean, it was a fiasco.
That's fine. I mean, it was. Either do it or don't do it.
Yeah. Fine. I mean, obviously, there's disagreement between John McDonnell and probably, you know, other people in the Labour Party, because he was one of the people sort of pushing against the idea of removing this position. To be honest, I thought the whole thing was a fiasco because I don't really see the point of removing Tom Watson's position as deputy leader of the Labour Party, because it doesn't have much constitutional power. The problem that the Labour left has is the constitution of the PLP. It's the fact that the PLP has only about 10% of its makeup who are genuinely pro the leadership and pro the project that the membership want to embark upon. And that, one, means that when they're in government, it's going to be pretty fucking fragile. Two, it means that there's not that many people to go out on TV and make the argument for why a Labour government would be a good thing, which I think has been a real problem for the project. But Tom Watson, I mean, the only power he really has is to go on Radio 4 every now and again to sort of contradict the leadership.
Yeah.
But I don't even think he has that much credibility.
And
I think
he's the deputy leader, right? That's why it's.
But McDonald's line of just, oh, Tom is Tom. He says what he wants. That's fine. I think that's good. There was a rule change that mattered at the NEC before conference, but it had nothing to do with getting rid of the position, which was to say, if and when the leader resigns, the deputy won't become the acting leader, because if he became the acting leader, that would give him a lot of constitutional real power. But they've said if a leader resigns, the acting leader will now be decided by the NEC.
Right.
So the only real constitutional power that he had was taken away from him, but yet there was this fight, which I don't think gains that much, other than the fact that you don't have this annoying guy, Tom Watson, appearing on the radio every now and again.
I would say that, look, the Labour Party should be a party of socialists in Parliament, not a parliamentary party, right? It's about the 500,000 members. It's not just about 300 people in Parliament, circa 300. Not at the moment, but if you're in government, obviously, 330 plus people. And I think a big step towards achieving that is, I think, we'd be getting rid of the deputy leader. Because that role of deputy leader necessarily emphasises how it is a parliamentary party. You've got the leader in Parliament, you've got the deputy leader. That's why I thought the General Secretary should be elected, personally. There's a good argument for and against, fine. But if we're serious about this being a party in Parliament, sure. But moreover, something that's embedded in everyday communities, you know, a vibrant, organic thing that's in society, like the Italian PCI back in the day, then, you know, I think getting rid of the deputy leader is healthy. But that wasn't why they were getting rid of it. They were getting rid of it because they don't like Tom Watson.
The final one said he and Corbyn would resign if Labour lose the next general election. I know this one pissed you off.
Just a dumb thing to say, isn't it? Dumb thing to say. The Tories have basically been on election footing for 10 weeks, right? The Tories have, arguably, actually, since the summer with Boris Johnson's campaign to win the Tory leadership, they've been on election footing, as have the Brexit Party. The Brexit Party are choosing all their candidates. And the shadow chancellor of the Exchequer is happily moving the political terrain for the Labour Party onto the defensive about who should be the successor to Jeremy Corbyn. At the precise moment, everybody else is gearing up for a general election. Following day, Jeremy Corbyn speaking to Sophie Rudge on Sky dealt with it very well. But then you hear Jess Phillips talking to LBC about, I'd like to be the leader and I'd be on Strictly. I mean, it's quite funny. But that's not the conversation we should be having.
She said she wants to be the first
leader to be on Strictly.
No, she wants to be the first ex-prime minister to be on Strictly. It's like she's planning so far in advance that she now wants to be a kooky Strictly contestant who's also been prime minister. It's just another sort of opportunity to have a good chapter in her next book.
I mean, fine. In a way, good luck to her. Obviously, I hope that never happens because it'll be a political catastrophe for the country. But I mean, in a way, good luck to her. It's quite funny. You know, I get the vibe that she's on self-promotion, being a celebrity, and doing some good along the way. That's probably what she thinks. Great, fine. I was very pissed off. You expect better from John McDonnell. He's a very sharp person.
What do you think is going on here then? So I think you're totally right there. I imagine he'd probably admit that the whole getting drawn into that question of a post-election leadership race was a mistake. I think we often talk on this show about message discipline. So when you get asked that question, you should pivot away to say, no, I think we're going to win the next general election. And because of the wealth inequality that exists in Britain, and because X, Y, Z, and people are pissed off at the levels of poverty, blah, 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 instead of sort of taking the question in good faith and giving Alistair Campbell exactly what he wants. But leave that aside. I mean, I think of John McDonnell as someone who's generally got, you know, good strategy, good tactics. Yeah. He's generally a very good performer. People fuck up every now and again.
Yeah, of course.
Do you think these divisions, and I think there are some differences between Corbyn and McDonnell, do you think they are tactical or political? And I think this is where you're getting real contentious disagreement at the moment, whereby people are saying, I suppose we'll get onto the second referendum general election question in a moment, but the fact that John McDonnell, for example, would have an interview with Alistair Campbell, and I can't imagine Jeremy Corbyn would, is that a political difference or a different tactical style?
It's both, isn't it? It's both, I think. Like, for instance, Jeremy Corbyn on politics, when it comes to foreign policy, I think it's right now is more militant than John McDonnell. And I think because of Alistair Campbell's role in the Second Iraq War, he would never do an interview with him. That then bleeds into your style of politics and how you comport yourself with people who John might say, you have to win some of these people over. And there were people saying he shouldn't go on GQ. That's a silly argument. He should go on absolutely everything to start with. But secondly, GQ, what's their average audience? 35 to 65 year old men. That's exactly who Labour need to win. So I can see the argument for speaking to Alistair Campbell. I think he probably should have, right? You're your shadow chancellor. You should absolutely speak to this figure and have that confrontation and, you know, ideally speak to people you otherwise can't reach. But where the mistake was, I think, with him is that John has been doing these very jocular events with The Times. He did a great podcast, Matt Shawley from The Times, with John McDonnell when he's talking to a business audience. And John is phenomenal. And his style was exactly the same. Very sardonic, jocular, I'm using lots of big words, fine. Very laid back and self-effacing, but also quite sharp and to the point. Really, really good. And I think basically and that's just been his autopilot, I reckon, for a couple of months, talking to the Bank of England, to the CBI, to all the business sort of bigwigs. And all of a sudden, that political style was transplanted into a conversation around internal left politics. So you can't go, you know, look, we'll be honest about what we want to nationalise, you know, and I'm happy to, you know, talk to so-and-so about the future of the British economy. You know, it's, you know, you need to win them over. That's great. All of a sudden, you're talking to Alistair Campbell about whether or not you're going to resign as Shadow Chancellor, if you come on, that's not jocular anymore. That's a very concrete political question. So, you know, and I think John he's become rightly obsessed with hegemonizing sort of the British business class with Labour's offer. And there is clearly a large part of the British sort of industrial interest, finance interest, not finance maybe, but the British capitalist class. Clearly, a lot of them are like, this is actually quite good. It's probably better than no deal. We see that sort of percolating through the Financial Times coverage, etc. So I get it. It's not a stupid thing to do. But the worry is that becomes his default, and then he applies that to conversations with the Lib Dems or Alistair Campbell. Or all of a sudden, before you know it, you're in government and it's talking about, you know, some foreign policy decision. You know, you can't have that softness with those kinds of decisions, because that's where your base is at. Right, this is not about a compromise to people you need to win over. These are actually the reasons why the people that voted you in the first place got behind you and Jeremy. So he needs to have, I think, a few kind of firewalls in place.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's important about it, the relationship to the base, I think, because I really respect this idea of being, you know, your policy and your policy, because I assume when he's going into these meetings with bankers, you know, he's being very polite. Obviously, I haven't seen any of these meetings, but what I imagine is, and what I imagine was going on with Alistair Campbell, actually, he's being very polite, but, you know, with quite a an understanding of that he's not compromising anything material. In that interview with Alistair Campbell, there was no material concessions, really.
No, about policy or anything.
Yeah.
No.
Well, I mean, I suppose you could say, are you going to prosecute? But, I mean, no one really thinks they're going to prosecute Tony Blair in The Hague. So, given that a Labour government is not going to indict Tony Blair for war crimes, then what's the point in suggesting you might do it?
There might be a there might be a far more critical inquiry as to Iraq.
Yeah.
That probably would happen.
And but I mean, I think you're right, which is that this wasn't a conversation happening in private where you might as well be polite about everything as long as you're not shifting on your policy positions, because for the base to see someone say, oh no, Tony Blair's not a war criminal, is a bit of a red line, isn't it? I mean, that was such a key driver of the Corbyn movement, which was opposition to the Iraq war and opposition to that particular element of the Tony Blair government. I think absolutely, as a Labour Party politician, you have to say that Tony Blair did a lot of good things. Sure start centres, reducing poverty, etc. But you can't compromise on Iraq, really. You can't even compromise, you know, in a performative way on Iraq. It's a red line.
But also there was the thing where he said, oh, you know, I really want Tony to be remembered for his work in Ireland, not for Iraq. Hate to break it to you, he's going to be remembered for Iraq.
And he should be remembered for
Iraq. Yeah, because hundreds of thousands of people died. He destabilised, he contributed to a war which massively destabilised the region. Even today, we're seeing its after effects with, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq are still basically failed states. Obviously, you had the emergence of ISIS in Syria. So, of course he's going to be remembered for that, not Ireland. Of course he is. You know, I hope he's remembered for the Good Friday Agreement. Well, he ain't going to be remembered for that. Believe me, in 100 years' time, he's going to be remembered for one thing and one thing only.
I think one thing that was really interesting in the interview, and I think one thing that infuriated people, I think, reasonably, is that there is very much a moral duplicity in saying, as he did, that he'd never... I don't know, that wasn't in the clip, actually. He said he'd never be able to forgive or be friends with a Conservative because of the pain they inflicted in austerity. But he didn't show the same attitude towards Tony Blair. And obviously, Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell, in fact, have caused probably more damage on a utilitarian level to the people of Iraq than the Conservatives ever did to the people of Britain
for
since
sure.
2010.
Inarguable.
So you can see a sort of moral duplicity there. But at the same time, from a strategic level, it's so obvious what McDonnell is trying to do, which is he's decided maybe too much. He's decided that Labour can only have a winning coalition if the insurgent force of Corbynism is combined with a sort of middle-class liberalism, and he thinks that's the only way you're going to get a majority in Britain.
Possibly.
And so he's trying to win over the middle-class liberals who might have some attachment
but
to New Labour.
Campbell isn't that.
Yeah, no, I mean,
that's what I don't get.
Yeah, I mean, we've had this discussion before on Tisky, actually.
That's what you're more than Bill, like, you're not reaching out to liberals, you're rehabilitating somebody who, until Brexit, Alistair Campbell was done.
Yeah.
Alistair Campbell was not in the public conversation.
What I will be interested to see, though, is if McDonnell speaks at the People's Vote campaign, because I actually think that probably would be worth it.
Oh, for sure.
He's far less is being compromised, and that is a movement that you do want to have some attachment to, even if Alistair Campbell is a figure who I kind of agree is irrelevant, fundamentally.
He spoke at the Defend Democracy demo, or I think we should call it Demand Democracy, and he went down really, really well. Mm. Of course you should speak there. It's Labour policy.
All right, let's do the substantive. We'll finish on this and then we'll go to questions. I want to hear your gossipy questions as well. I want to hear where you sit on the great divide of 2019, that between some staffers in the leaders of the opposition's office and the shadow chancellor. We are going to go to...
Sorry, I'm going to say somebody's put here, as a disabled person living on benefits, fuck you for that comment, Michael, about austerity in Iraq. I mean, inarguable, sorry.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could also equally have someone in the comments saying, as an Iraqi whose parents were killed in the war, fuck you for saying austerity was worse than
Iraq. I mean, we used our armed forces used depleted uranium against Fallujah. You need to Google, anybody should Google this, depleted uranium.
Yeah, that doesn't Fallujah. Make austerity any less disgusting.
They're both evil. The point is, you know, we used depleted uranium against civilian populations. Now their children have birth defects like you see in Chernobyl. You know, but the thing is, Chernobyl was a complete disaster. Fallujah, we chose to do that. Or our political leaders chose to do that.
All right, second referendum or general election first. One of the big tactical disagreements, other than do we want to appeal to liberals or is Alistair Campbell's a useful audience to be speaking to? The big one, basically, is about a second referendum. And lots of this dispute is being framed through this prism. And so there is now agreement across the Labour Party that there will be a second referendum. I mean, it's embraced with varying degrees of enthusiasm. But the debate is, should the Labour Party push for a general election first and a second referendum afterwards, or a second referendum first and a general election afterwards. What's being briefed is that, again, people like John McDonnell, Keir Starmer, Emily Formbury, they're all pushing for a second referendum first. And people like Ian Lavery, John Trickett, and Carrie Murphy. So one of the lenses that this has been viewed through is that McDonnell pushed her to the side because he wanted a second referendum first. How true that is, I'm not entirely sure. But that frames this debate. Aaron, what do you think?
I think that the idea you have a referendum before the general election is completely batshit.
Why?
Well, I think Remain will absolutely win. I will go on record to say Remain can't lose if 16 to 18 year olds have the vote and EU nationals have the vote. Remain literally can't lose. However, will you be able to extend and expand the franchise 5-6 million people with a government of national unity? I don't think you can. I don't think you'd have the numbers, but B, there's a really strong democratic argument to say you shouldn't do that anyway. Put that to one side, sod that. Could you do it? I don't think you could. There's also this argument being made, let's have a quick referendum in 6 weeks. You definitely then can't add 6 million people to the electoral roll. And like from a purely pragmatic point of view, if you have them on the electoral roll, you will win. But also, surely we want a considered debate about Brexit. People say, well, we've been having that for 3 years. We haven't had that on a specific version of Leave. That's half the problem. So all of a sudden, you're seeing these debates around, let's have a referendum on Boris's deal. No, absolutely not. Why would you want a referendum without the things I've just talked about, extending the vote that would benefit you? Why would you want to vote on a deal that's crap when the alternative at least is a Leave deal, which would be a Labour Leave deal, which, let's be real, is going to be the softest of soft Brexits? It just doesn't make any sense to me. It's the latest fixation in a series of fixations for the Labour right, parts of the sort of liberal establishment, which kind of there's like a Venn diagram going on here. And they just, you know, it was the, at one point it was the European Economic Area, then it was a people's vote, and then it's this, and then it's that. And they sort of, and now they almost prefer any kind of vote to actually stopping Brexit. They can't disassociate these two things. The fetish object has become the second referendum rather than actually stopping Brexit.
Well, I'm not sure if that's
there's true. This weird obsession. Jonathan Freedom, just as we're about to see a new Jonathan Freedom wants a referendum. People's vote was never meant to be about Boris's deal or not. It was about the ideal was to stop Brexit, apparently.
Yeah, but that's still so. I mean, I'm sure that Jonathan Freedom thinks that to have because I mean, the argument from these people is that if you have a general election, I mean, this is the argument as Tony Blair keeps saying it whenever he appears on television. If you have a general election, there'll be lots of issues in the mix. These people obviously don't have that much faith in Jeremy Corbyn to be able to win a general election. And so they assume that Boris Johnson will get a stomping majority and then he'll be able to put through his fairly hard Brexit deal without a second referendum. So if that's your base assumption, which I don't think it is for McDonnell or Starmer, but I do think it is obviously for Jonathan Freeland. It's still rational, it's coherent. They think the only way you're going to be able to stop Brexit is if you do it before the general election and before, in their minds, Boris Johnson gets a stomping majority.
So you lose the first referendum. You think that Remain parties would lose another general election. God, I mean, this is just ridiculous.
Well, I mean, the polls suggest that there's at least a 50-50 chance that Remain would win. I think probably 60-40 chance that Remain would win a second referendum.
Oh, no, clearly.
And especially
it's
when...
It's the margin of error, but yeah.
Especially when, with Boris Johnson's deal, it will all be spelled out how much damage that's going to do to the economy. So I think there was...
But then you look at a general election...
showing that it would reduce incomes by, I think, £2,500 a
compared
year.
Compared to Labour, yeah. This is,
no, that's just compared to the status quo
right,
as well.
The FT did a...
The FT one, yeah, that was based on a no-deal Brexit or a hard Brexit.
Right.
I think. But that wasn't when this specific deal had been published.
But we're talking about percentages and probabilities. Let's just pluck a number out of my arse. The point is, if there was a general election tomorrow, the most likely outcome is another hung parliament.
Well, I mean, that's very difficult to say, isn't it?
Well, no, but look, most of the polling, you see, for
depends how much faith you have in the ability of both parties to run a functional campaign.
Most,
depends
no,
how the, you know, like, what everyone's agreed is that it's completely unpredictable
Most polling, no, but you have some polling that increasingly few polls show this, Labour being the largest party, some showing the Tories being the largest party, some showing the Tories have a slight majority, but there's nothing which gives the Tories like this big, stonking majority they would need. So... if you're talking about probabilities and the most likely outcome, they can't on the one hand say, look, if we have a general election, we won't change anything because we'll still have a hung parliament, which is probably
that's
true.
That's a stupid argument. I think that's a stupid argument.
Right now. No, but they're saying that on the one hand, but then on the other hand, they're saying, well, we don't want a general election because Boris Johnson could win it. It just seems so, it seems so strange to me. Why on earth are you're going to have a referendum, and presumably this referendum happens with the government of national unity?
Well, that's the thing, yeah. So So if it was possible to have, if Boris Johnson said, look, I'll pass my deal if you have a second referendum, and he said that his government was going to be willing to implement it, I actually think that would be an ideal democratic outcome. Because I don't think that... I think the idea that Labour's Leave option is going to be more credible as a Leave option than Boris Johnson's Leave option is a bit ridiculous. I think it would be better. I'd prefer a soft Brexit
to a hard Brexit. Northern Ireland?
Well, I mean, at the moment, if you have a Northern Ireland-only backstop, I mean, people in...
The
Northern Ireland-only backstop was quite popular in Northern Ireland. And basically what Boris Johnson is coming back with now is a hard Brexit deal with a Northern Ireland backstop. Northern Ireland's going to stay in the European Customs Union in the single market. And so the reason I don't want that is because the reason Boris Johnson wants that is because he wants to have a bargain basement Britain that can strike free trade deals with the United States. But that's definitely, that's a credible option. I mean, if you want to have a hard Brexit...
I'm not saying it's not credible, but clearly it does jeopardise the Good Friday Agreement, because all the projections show that Northern Ireland all of a sudden become, like you say, it would see a massive decline in foreign direct investment. It would see a major economic downturn.
The original backstop was going to be really good for...
This latest one. Tom Cabassi did some Insta analysis on it.
Oh, on this latest one?
Yeah. And so basically, you know, and if you believe that economic dysfunction could lead, therefore, to sort of political breakdown of some kind, which perfectly, perfectly possible. So, I mean, or the Labour position was, we leave the European Union, we stay in the single market, the whole of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. That literally changes nothing on the Irish border. Nothing.
Yeah, but the idea that
Boris's offer and the Labour sort of Brexit are the same thing.
Not the same thing, but I'm saying...
You said there's no point, you know. There's no difference.
Well, the reason I think there's no difference is because I actually think there is... I think it's healthier democratically for there to be a Leave option which is genuinely backed by Leavers and backed by the government against a Remain option which is genuinely backed by Remainers and backed by the opposition. And even though I think Labour are absolutely right to go into the next general election saying we will negotiate a soft Brexit versus Remain, that's not exactly an ideal situation. I mean, many people will see that second referendum as a complete farce. I mean, I still think it's the right policy, but you have to recognise the downsides of it, which is that there'll be a very high abstention rate because many people will say, what's the point in having a soft Brexit? We just don't want to give this vote legitimacy. And that wouldn't be a problem, I don't think, if it was Boris Johnson's deal versus Remain. I think then you'd get a very high turnout. So I do think that
it's either going to be no deal, Boris's deal, or a second referendum. So you're making it sound like there will not be it's increasingly likely there's going to have to be a second referendum.
No, so the question is, do you have a second referendum before or after a general election?
Right.
So I think if you had a second referendum before a general election where it was Boris Johnson as Prime Minister fighting for his hard Brexit deal and the Labour Party as the opposition fighting for Remain, that would be a neat democratic outcome because then the people would have pursued that. I do, yeah. I mean, I don't think it will happen, for one. I don't think there'll be the numbers in Parliament. So I think the idea that we split the movement based on this tactical question is a bit silly. But I think that that would be a less damaging outcome than a second referendum afterwards. And also...
Do you not think it's morally bad to have a second referendum when EU nationals aren't enfranchised and they're the ones directly affected? You don't think that's a
Well,
big
I think
thing?
If we're worrying about the legitimacy of this second referendum, to be honest, I think changing the franchise is really fucking risky. I mean, I think...
Why?
Because if there is a...
We want to give them a vote in a general election next time round. So
yeah, but
that's policy.
Yeah, no, I'm in favour of 16-year-olds and EU nationals getting the vote. But I think if it looks like they're being enfranchised specifically to overturn a vote which happened 2 years ago on a different franchise, then there are rightly going to be, or understandably going to be, some people saying this looks a bit fishy. And I think if it looks as if you're using EU nationals precisely to win a vote or overturn a vote from 2 years previously, you're actually putting EU nationals in a fairly vulnerable position in the extent to which people are going to think you've been used.
You don't need to go that far. I just think they should have the vote. What I'm saying is, from a sort of pragmatic perspective of some of these Remain ultras, I don't see why they'd prefer a referendum which didn't include EU nationals to one that does include EU nationals.
Well, because
either from a pragmatic point of view or from an ethical point of view.
The pragmatic point of view is because they don't think we'll get a referendum at all unless we have it before a general election, because they think that the most likely outcome of a general election is the Tories get a stomping majority and then we leave. So, I mean, you can disagree with that, but it's coherent. I think to pretend it's not coherent.
Well, we've said it's incoherent because they say that on the one hand, on the other hand, they say we shouldn't have a general election because it will lead to another hung parliament.
Well, it's incoherent if they use both of those positions, but that's pointing at a big mass and picking out two arguments and saying it's incoherent because both of these arguments are coming from your big mass. I mean, I think you can have a very coherent argument. I mean, often the thing, it's like the Hillary Benz where they're on TV and they're saying, oh, well, if we have a general election, the outcome will be a hung parliament. What he really means is, well, this is...
I don't want Jeremy Corbyn to be prime minister.
Well, so he means either one of two things, probably both, which is I don't want Jeremy Corbyn to be prime minister, or I don't think Labour Party are going to win the next general election and probably the Tories will get a majority. So I mean, there's two coherent positions there.
Yeah.
And there's an interesting debate about which one he means. Probably he would agree with both of those statements.
Yeah.
So he has no reason not
bad.
To ask for a second referendum yeah. beforehand. But I do think there is a danger that...
So why does John McDonnell want a referendum before the next general election then? So we've worked out those guys. What about McDonnell and Starmer?
Well, I think probably on one level they're worried that the Labour Party isn't in a particularly good shape to win a general election because they think that Boris Johnson's got a clearer line on Brexit than the Labour Party do. So if the dividing line in the forthcoming general election will be between Leave and Remain, Boris Johnson is well placed to hegemonise the Leave vote.
Always was.
And the Labour Party is still incredibly divided on the Remain issue.
They're not divided on the Remain issue. It's just that we always knew that the Tory party was more concrete around a particular EU outcome. That was before 2016 than Labour was. That's nothing new.
Well, they are divided. And I mean, the noises you'll hear from them are different depending on who you're speaking to, because some of them want to remain and some of them want to leave. That's completely legitimate. Mm. I'm not saying this is necessarily a critique. I'm just stating the fact.
Mm.
And so they think that if you have this referendum beforehand, you get that. I mean, also, to be honest, I think if Boris Johnson stays in... This is why it won't happen, because if Boris Johnson stays in government, puts a referendum to Remain versus Leave, and the Labour Party are the main opposition arguing for Remain, he's the government arguing for Leave. I think Remain will win. I think that will be a huge blow to Boris Johnson and a big relief to the Labour Party and many of the people who were... I mean, I think that would increase Jeremy Corbyn's status as a political leader, which is why it's not going to happen. And that means... Which is why... And I mean... It's a tactical question for me. It's not going to happen because Boris Johnson won't let it happen. The only way it could happen is with a government of national unity. And that is where you get into a very difficult strategic question for the Labour Party. Because I do think that if you have a government of national unity, which isn't headed by Jeremy Corbyn, there is a real danger of a new, you know, national party, which basically tries to usurp or outflank the Labour Party as the opposition to Boris Johnson at the next general election. So I can see why there are people who are really suspicious of that option. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn would get kicked out of the leader of the opposition office, for example. He wouldn't have the same rights to ask questions at prime minister's questions. You'd have Ken Clark versus Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn on the sidelines.
It wouldn't be Ken Clark.
Ken Clark or Harriet Harman or whoever, Margaret Beckett, whoever they're talking about.
Why are they so obsessed with Margaret Beckett?
But basically, this is what... It's a tactical question for me. It doesn't seem particularly political unless you have what I think is not a particularly coherent argument, which is that the people need to have a Labour Leave option presented to them. Because if Labour Leave essentially means very soft Brexit, the idea that the people really need to have a really soft Brexit put to them versus Remain, which is marginally different, I think is a bit ridiculous. I think if the people can have put to them a hard Brexit versus Remain, that is a democratically much more neat outcome. But again, it's all neither here nor there, because I think by Saturday we'll have a second referendum ruled out as an option and we'll be heading straight towards a general election. And then the whole relevant debate will be how we campaign in that and what our message is when it comes to Brexit. And I think probably that's what the real disputes are about within the Labour Party at the moment. This idea that it's about when we have a general election or a referendum, I think is probably a distraction. What's going on is that McDonnell wants to run a particular kind of general election campaign. There are other people in the party who want to run a slightly more Leavey campaign, and a bunch of disagreements about management styles, and that's what's going on. The fight is about the general election, not about the second referendum, in my opinion.
Okay. Any other business? Questions?
Questions. Let's get your questions. Oh, it is a bit sweaty in here, isn't it?
Oh, somebody said that.
No, that's what I've said.
Excuse me.
Okay.
It's dusty because we've been moving so much stuff around, and we're moving to our fantastic new studio thanks to the kind generosity of our subscribers. If you're not one of them,
support.novarramedia.com.
Help us build a new media for different politics. Help Michael host a Tisky pretty much every night during a general election.
That's the idea.
I can't imagine how you could be even better informed than you already are, because you're Novara Media viewers, but you would be.
I thought you were talking about me there.
No, yeah. Come on.
I have to do a lot more research if we have a nightly show. First question, Matthew Cole. Say Labour win a general election and negotiate Brexit. How will Corbyn credibly answer the question, how is your deal better than remaining in the EU? Well, I mean, for one, that won't necessarily be a question he has to answer.
Where's this? What's the question?
This is from Matthew Cole. Say Labour win a general election and negotiate Brexit. How will Corbyn credibly answer the question, is your deal better than remaining in the EU? If he's staying neutral, he doesn't have to answer that question. He can just say they're different options.
Yeah, depends. Look, people that want to leave the EU will find it a better option. People that want to remain will find it a worse option.
Well, to be honest, many people who voted leave will think it's completely irrelevant and try and boycott the referendum. But I mean, that's also.
But you've got. I mean, you had a really good take on this. You're like, good.
The
2016 ballot got a bunch of people out who don't normally vote, and actually it suits both the Tories and Labour.
Oh, yeah, not good. No, I don't mean ethically good, though.
No. But yeah. it suits the Tories as well if these people never vote ever again. They're perfectly happy with that.
Yeah, because they were never going to vote. Yeah.
Because it's like that's several million people who don't normally turn out who voted for Leave has disrupted politics as normal.
The reason I think you could have that and it would be democratic is if Labour won a general election on that position.
So we don't agree with that, by the way. Yeah, we're radical Democrats. Yeah. I'm just saying what you've analytically highlighted before, which is very important.
Okay, so what would Jeremy Corbyn say? How is your deal better than remaining in the EU? He'd say, look, I've got a deal and I've got remaining. I'm not necessarily telling you to vote for either of them. I'm just saying here's what the facts are. Someone like John Trickett, for example, has said he will campaign for the Labour Leave. I respect that. I think that's a good position to come out and say that. I think it is important that there'll be some people on the front bench making that case. To be honest, I think his main argument will be because people voted to leave, and I do think we should follow through with that. I think it creates disenfranchisement if people feel that they voted for something and then it doesn't happen. So I would prefer for the confirmatory referendum, if that's what they're calling it, to confirm the deal as opposed to rejecting the deal. I mean, potentially you'll have some other answers about state aid, but it looks like if it's just going to be a very soft Brexit, then the only advantage is that it respects people's desire to have left the European Union. Do you agree?
Agree.
You don't think there's going to be anything more substantive in it?
I just want Brexit to be done, to be honest. As long as it's not completely mad, like sort of Boris Johnson's deal, I'm kind of ambivalent. It's kind of why I want Labour's thing to be on the table, because basically either outcome's okay.
You've got a quiz question here.
Okay, go on.
With a prize. So A. Dubuis asks, who is the official resident of Downing Street? Aaron gets free food for a month at my restaurant if he can answer this question correctly.
The official resident at Downing Street.
Yeah. Is it something related to the... No, it's not related to the Queen. We're something in... Well, it can't be the Prime Minister because that would be too obvious.
Is it the Lord Chancellor?
Oh, is it the Lord Chancellor, A. Dubuis? We'll have to wait for
A. Dubuis, he'll get back to us.
We'll have to wait for him to answer that question, or if anyone else in the audience knows the answer to that.
Hey, we didn't talk about Kurdistan. Maybe take a Kurdish question.
Is there a Kurdish question?
Yeah. There was a question from Kayleigh Browncoat as well. Should a second Scottish independence referendum be the price of a Labour SNP coalition?
Sure, why not?
I agree. I think a lot of Scots, when they see this, like, we're like, we're English and we're on the left, they expect us to be like, no, save the union. We're like, it's your country. Generally speaking, I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, maybe it wouldn't. So,
but the SNP don't want one either, right? That's
well, because the argument that's made about this is that the SNP, for them to put Boris Johnson in number 10 because of a refusal of Labour to give them a second referendum would be politically toxic for them. Be like 1979 over again, and people would see, look, you are so ideological, you're so belligerent that you've chosen the possibility for a second referendum over well-funded public services, and you've lumbered us with a hard Brexit with this fucking idiot. Mm. You know, so I think actually Labour in a very strong position to negotiate with the SNP at that point, and probably what will happen is you'll have some agreement on a, you know, potentially a constitutional convention or something which pushes things into the long grass, where you say if you can demonstrate, there'll be some sort of inbuilt principle of consent, I imagine.
Yeah. Which suits the SNP down to the ground.
Actually, it also makes sense because there's a difference between Scotland and Northern Ireland, which is written into the Good Friday Agreement, is this principle of consent whereby if Republicans can demonstrate, or well, it's somewhat vague how it would be demonstrated, but it's written into the agreement that if it can be demonstrated that there is a majority for Irish unity in Northern Ireland, then there should be a referendum. So it's not purely in the gift of Westminster. In Scotland, you have a different situation. It's purely in the gift of Westminster. So in theory, legally, you could have polls saying that 70% of Scottish voters want independence. And legally, Parliament can just say, or Westminster can just say, no, you're sticking with us. And because Scotland only have, 57 representatives at Westminster, there could be a permanent majority blocking independence. So a neat solution to SNP Labour negotiations post general election would not be to give a second referendum there and then on Scottish independence, but to agree to some sort of legal framework whereby the power to grant Scotland a second referendum resides in Scotland as opposed to resides in Britain.
I like it. I actually think as well, this is the big question now for people in England. I wouldn't say the English left, because I don't think such a thing exists. People in England, there's a great book out on this, by the way, Alex Niven's new book coming out soon, New Model Ireland, great book. Is how do we deal with the constitutional breakup of the United Kingdom in England? Because the idea of like a left-wing English nationalism, I find very stupid. Don't think it's going to happen. But it poses difficult questions, because right now that terrain's almost, it's monopolised by the right. Du Bois, by the way, said it was the first Lord of the Treasury.
Oh, it's the first Lord of the Treasury. And who is that?
No idea.
Is that is that a weird constitutional name for the Prime Minister? No.
No.
I suppose that's a follow-up question. If anyone knows who is the first
Lord of the Treasury.
Yeah, you can tell us that. Okay, here is a Syria question. Joe Broderick, is the US withdrawal of troops of Syria aimed to make Trump appear to be less of a war hawk than he is? That's an interesting question.
Well, Trump's initial sort of messaging on foreign policy in 2016 was isolationism. Mm. And it's a really popular message with the US. End the wars, bring these guys out of these theatres of combat, which are the other side of the world. And that was American foreign policy doctrine, really, until the Second World War.
Mm.
So it's not a new thing.
Well, obviously this is not the most important thing that's going on when it comes to the withdrawal of American troops in northeast Syria. But in terms of why it is happening, in terms of Trumpian domestic politics, we were talking earlier about a wedge issue. And what you want as a politician for a wedge issue is something that is actually sort of common sense and agreed among the general population, but whereby your political opponents are forced to very loudly disagree with you. And I think you could actually look at this as an issue like that, right? So the whole Republican establishment and the Democratic Party and the media and, the whole political establishment in America, including the army, is saying you shouldn't have sold out the Kurds because you owe them your allegiance because they've been our allies on the ground fighting ISIS. Now, Donald Trump might do, I haven't seen the polling on this, but he might be thinking, look, I know that there is actually a common sense undercurrent in the American population where they don't give a shit about Syrian Kurds. What they care about is us wasting our money on foreign wars. So I'll let the political establishment, I'll let the Democrats, I'll let Lindsey Graham, I'll let CNN and these people in the military decry my bringing back troops from Rojava, from northeast Syria, and let them disagree with me because I know that there's an underlying agreement in the public that, one, they don't think that American wars abroad are particularly good, and two, that they don't want America to be acting as a policeman defending peoples they don't actually give a shit about. So potentially it is a smart electoral
strategy.
That's
all true. That is all true, but it's also an embarrassment for the US. And Trump was obsessed with Benghazi. Remember when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State and there was this Benghazi kind of operation that went completely wrong? He was trying to get Hillary Clinton charged with criminal offences, etc. And what he did, what's happened in the last week, is far worse than Benghazi. Far, far worse. The Kurds have been working alongside the US for 5 years there. They have details, they have probably quite useful information for the Russians.
Weren't Americans killed in Benghazi, though?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying, but it was like a foreign policy fuck-up.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is if...
You've not defended our interests. It's an embarrassment. It's humiliation.
Donald Trump comes from this position that actually the only thing that really, sticks in the minds of the American voters is a dead American.
Yeah.
And if it's a brown person, they just don't care. if it's, you know, that's actually his whole rhetoric around it was, look, there's this tribal historic, you know, the Kurds and the Turks, they just hate each other.
Yeah,
these
yeah,
are basically
no,
just
I agree with
primitive,
all that.
Inhuman people, and why should we take sides?
I agree
here,
with all that.
As long as there's no
do
dead
think,
American,
though,
and there was
do,
dead Americans
do you
in
not
Benghazi.
Think it's like, yeah, I know what you're saying, but he's a Republican. This whole thing is like terrorism, safety, and, you know, a decision made by him has led potentially to the... And obviously the Kurds are going to sort of really emphasise this. We don't know the precise numbers, but clearly ISIS prisoners are escaping from prison. Mm. That has happened. It's, and let's say it's in the hundreds, right? Or it could be in the thousands. Do you not think that undermines this kind of message against terrorism? If, like, literally ISIS terrorists...
No, I mean, obviously it should do.
...were, you know, were able to escape because of the decision he made. I mean, it just... I mean, okay... I'm not
it's
saying
interesting
I'm,
to see how it plays
I'm
out.
I'm not going
to
say that's going to. I'm not. He's going to lose the presidency on it, but clearly it does nullify a potential line of attack which he will want to say, which is like, we're so strong. It's like, no, you're such a dumbass. Actually, your decision meant thousands of ISIS, you know, soldiers, combatants, you know, escaped, and they're now a risk to America again. All it takes is for one of those people to attack a US airbase or a military installation or a warship somewhere. One person who we think was
in an ISIS prison, that's true.
He's fucked. He's not fucked, but, you know, it's a big story.
Olim Kask says, every time I like this video, it automatically unlikes it, which is a conspiracy against Navarra Media. So to make up for this deep state conspiracy against Navarra Media, which won't let Olim Kask, I don't know how you'd pronounce that, like our videos. Can you like our video? Make up for that one. The more of you that like it, the more people's feeds it appears in, and the easier it is for us to get the word out about Tisky Sour and Navarra Media.
Somebody said here, English left doesn't exist. Seriously, just go to Toll Puddle Festival. I love Toll Puddle, and as a southerner, I find it fascinating. But I do think there are distinct differences between social life in the southeast of England and the northeast of England. I just think that's just a fact. And actually, the northeast of England shares a lot more in common with Scottish borders than it does with the southeast of England. Just reality. It's the idea that you have this kind of contiguous English identity, like you do with Scotland or with Ireland or with Wales. I don't think that's true.
Let's see. I'm seeing if there's any. Will Wood Labour give political asylum to those in Catalonia involved in organising the referendum? It's an interesting question because I don't know if. Well, I mean, we should, obviously. Belgium was giving political asylum to the leader of... Because I was just... What I was going to ask is, can an EU member state give a resident of another EU member state political asylum?
Yes.
And they can.
Yes. It happened in 1970, in the late 70s, between Italy and France.
Oh, yeah, of
course. About 1,500 distance left Italy, went to France. And it was called, like, the Mitterrand Doctrine or something.
Did that include Negri? No.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think that in Belgium... What was his name?
Puigdemont.
Yeah, he was given. Was he given asylum in Belgium, or at least he was hiding out in Belgium, and they couldn't get an extradition request for him?
Yeah, and I think there's certain arguments to be made. You could probably appeal to various, you know, like in this country, you could probably appeal to the Human Rights Act or something, and you'd have maybe an argument.
There'd be a lot of real politic, presumably. So it would be about leverage. So I don't know if Labour were in power. Probably they'd be inclined to give political asylum to the... You know who would be inclined to give political asylum to the Catalonians would be the Scottish, actually. I can imagine that.
That would just happen, probably. Perfect example.
Although, to be honest, if they want to rejoin the EU as an independent state, then potentially they don't want to piss off a country that's got veto power. Who knows? The question's too hypothetical, even if it is interesting, for us to give a definitive answer to.
Yeah.
Right. This is an interesting one. I don't really know.
Should we take one or two more?
Yeah, we'll take two more. Dexius asks, do you think the way Labour Party members talk at their conference, i.e. saying comrade, pushes away traditional working class voters?
Don't really care.
Yeah.
I mean, what are they meant to call them? If they say brothers and sisters, people go, well, I don't talk to most people like that. Colleagues, it sounds like you're in the office. Just comrades, it's fine. People say it with regards to soldiers, right? They say comrades in arms. Nobody goes, oh, people, you know, don't like, if it's relevant language, if you're describing two soldiers fighting in a war zone, that's historically how the word's been used.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing about Labour Party conference that sort of commented upon is, and where there's a stark contrast with the Conservative Party conference. And something that I love about it, actually, is you've got just hundreds of people going up and giving really impassioned speeches,
totally.
Which is live on BBC, live on Sky News,
totally.
And to an audience of, you know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 politically engaged
yeah.
people.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that we have this movement of people who can give, you know, impassioned, you know, some of them are boring, some of them are repetitive, some of them are amazing, you know, and every now and again you get this real electric moment when someone yeah. stands up from a CLP and gives an impassioned speech about mental health or austerity
yeah.
Or an argument about what rule change they want, you know, and it can be, I think, yeah, whether they say comrade or not,
that's the least of our worries.
That's the least of our worries.
It's a regular person participating in the conversation of a party which aspires to govern, you know, the fifth biggest economy in the world. That's really cool. I was at this event actually on Saturday in Hastings, and Diane Abbott was on a round table with around 15 people. And one of them was a recent refugee from Syria. And she was talking to Diane Abbott about, you know, what should be done in Syria. And let's be real, there's no other major political party in Britain that operates like that. The Shadow Home Secretary talking to somebody who's just come from Syria about how we should respond to it politically. It's very, very rare. You know, Labour has some problems. It also has a lot of really good things.
Someone says, Jay says, can you stop naming segments and newsletters after obscure middle-class hipster drinks, please? Where is... Cortado is...
Spanish, right?
Isn't it? Well, I mean, because I lived in Spain for a year and obviously you didn't call it a cortado, you just called it a coffee.
Yeah,
but I think the idea of a cortado is it is the same. That's how the Spanish cortado. Do coffee.
Well, I mean, isn't it just café con leche?
Yeah,
I don't get it.
But they don't call it well. Cause
that's what that's what I mean. I don't know where's cortado come from.
Well, I don't know who invented the word cortado. Cortado, what would it mean? Well, because the point is, it's bigger than us. We can't just call it a
does coffee. Does it mean it's shortened? Is that what it means? Cortado. Corto yeah. means short in Italian.
Yeah, it probably means shortened. So it's a shortened...
I mean, probably in Spaniard in the comments, flat white, fucking idiots, it means this.
We call it a cortado because it's bigger than an espresso and it's smaller than a flat white.
Look,
so you need a name for that middle size.
I wanted the newsletter to be called Frothy Coffee after Authenticrat in Chief Owen Smith's 2016 campaign kicked off in a cafe in Pontypridd. And he said, oh, I don't normally have one of these frothy coffees, you know. Yeah, she's referring to cappuccino.
Hammer Time says, okay, this puts off the working class way more than comrade. I think that was about our conversation about cortados and coffee sizes.
What if the working class is Spanish?
Well, they'd call it café con leche,
yeah,
café so con it's leche. Irrelevant.
Yeah. But it's like croissants being middle class. It's like, mate, they're fucking 30p in Lidl. Give me a break.
All right, let's choose a final question.
Go on then.
Do people that are left in Change UK still refer to each other as fellow cucks? There's only two of them, I think, isn't there? Gavin Shuker.
No, there's three, no?
Mike Gapes.
Joan Ryan.
And Anna Soubry.
Oh, no, Joan Ryan's left for the Lib Dems.
Did she get allowed into the Lib Dems?
I mean, she's
yeah,
got,
she did. She
she's
did.
Got really
she
bad
did.
Politics.
So it's Anna Soubry and Chris
Gapes.
Leslie.
And Gapes won't join Lib Dems because like his pro-NATO position, was it? He's mad as a fucking hatter. It's amazing how these like completely weird figures were like just given a free pass by some, you know, the sensible people in the Labour Party. He is a real, I'm going to be kind, an iconoclast. Gapes, that is.
Oh, I thought you were going to be... I thought you were going to come out with... Anyway, let's call it an evening, eh?
You don't think Gapes is iconoclast? Okay, fine.
No, I was looking at questions and got distracted. So
cortado, shortened cut. Okay, there you go. Cut with milk.
Tomorrow night, we will be back for an episode of Tisky Sour with Luke Savage from Jacobin. He is Canadian, so we're going to talk about the Canadian elections next Saturday. We'll also have Ellie Mae O'Hagan on, freelance journalist, often writes for The Guardian. So we'll be talking about whatever's going on in British politics that day, probably a little bit about Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. It's going to be a very good show. And there'll be also a show later in the week, depending on what happens. Presumably something for those negotiations that are going to be going on. Is it in Brussels? Where's the meeting? Anyway, the meeting of the EU Council to
Brussels,
work
Strasbourg.
Out whether
Although the
or not
European,
Boris Johnson
the European
is going to come back with
actually,
a deal.
It's not related to the EU, the European Council, just to be clear.
Is that true?
People get confused between the Council of Ministers and the European Council. They're separate bodies. Anyway.
You learn something new every day. On that note, you've been watching Tisky Sour. You've been watching Navarra Media. As you know, this show is only possible because of your kind support. If you are already a subscriber, thank you very much. That's what makes this possible. If not, please go to support.navarramedia.com and donate the equivalent of 1 hour's wage a month so we can keep growing, upping our output, and building hegemony for the British left. Not on that, because, I mean, hegemony on the British left would be pointless. We need the left to be bigger.
Everywhere. Can I just say thanks for tuning in? We've had at one point almost 1,200 people watching tonight. At the same time, England spanked Bulgaria, apparently 6-0. So I think that just shows the hunger for radical ideas and the fervent political moment that we all inhabit.
Good night. Thank you.